this afternoon is the Schumach case. Counsel, as soon as Mr. Reutzel and Mr. Duschinger have cleared out, you can set up, and you can proceed when you're ready.
Good afternoon. I'm Brian Murphy. I represent Mr. Schumach. And may it please the court, I'll begin. I actually feel that the written arguments in this case draft the issues pretty well. They talk about the legal standards that apply pretty well and show that the instruction on negligence per se should have been given. The statutes that we relied on prohibited a driver from passing on the right or changing lanes without looking, driving on the sidewalk, or approaching an obviously disabled person without stopping and taking every precaution necessary to make sure that that person didn't get harmed. Mr. Schumach was sitting on the sidewalk in his wheelchair at the time of the accident, and that's where he was hit. Defendant's only argument is, I didn't drive on the sidewalk, I was pushed on the sidewalk, which is a question of fact for a jury to determine, not for the judge to determine this case. They had presented evidence that, in fact, defendant did drive onto the sidewalk, that he turned his wheel and that he stepped on the gas, and that those actions were not simply forced upon him by the accident. They weren't jerking motion, they weren't a question of force, that he had to consciously choose to turn the wheel and step on the gas.
Let me ask you, just because there is a steering implication or accelerator being pushed, does that mean necessarily that it was a voluntary action?
Yes, sir. Our expert testified at trial that it was, in fact voluntary.
And would you do you recall which page of the record that was?
I'm not pretty sure I said it in the brief, but I can.
I'm aware of one part where the expert said that they were talking about that there would have had to have been steering and acceleration, and he responded, "There is definitely conscious input for steering and acceleration."
Yes, Your Honor.
Which it's a little bit ambiguous. It could mean that typically there is conscious input for steering and acceleration, but. Can you stretch it so far as to say that in the 1.3 seconds that this man had to act, that it would necessarily have been a voluntary act?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, the expert went a little bit further in saying, in evaluating the forces that were applied, it wasn't just an automatic reaction from being hit. His foot wasn't forced onto the gas pedal as a result of being hit. His arms weren't jerked to turn the wheel. Now, whether he chose to hit Mr. Schumach is the standard that defendant wants relied upon, and I don't think that's an accurate standard. I'm hoping he didn't consciously choose to hit Mr. Schumach, but he did consciously choose to turn the wheel towards the right in order to avoid the van in front of him. He made that decision very quickly. It was an ill-informed decision, but that's the difference between negligence per se and negligence here. The question that the jury addressed was whether a reasonable person would have made that decision under the circumstances, and they find they could not find that it was negligent under that standard. However, that's not the duty imposed by negligence per se. The duty imposed by negligence per se is, did he abide by the statute? And clearly he did not. He did not do any of the things required by those three statutes. And in the case cited in the briefing, I mean, the Colorado Supreme Court and a division of the Court of Appeals as well. I believe it was Zink, but it's in the reply brief that a person was found negligent per se for causing an accident and leaving the scene of the accident, even though he didn't even know that there was an accident and somebody was injured. Just the fact that there was an accident and that somebody was injured and that he left violated negligence per se. And in this case, the fact that defendant turned the wheel, pressed on the gas, turned right, and hit a person who was on the sidewalk violates those three statutes. And that's the difference between negligence per se and just straight negligence in this case.
Okay, I understand that in a traffic statute, it's considered a strict liability offense, which means that you don't necessarily have to have a culpable mental state, such as knowing that you hit someone when you drove away. Mm-hmm. But it still implies a voluntary act. And I'm a little bit concerned that just saying that someone steered the wheel or pressed the accelerator necessarily, by the nature of those acts, had to be voluntary acts.
Well, I would say two things. First, that the defendant himself told the police officer that he tried to avoid hitting the van in front of him, which definitely implies voluntary action. He turned the wheel, tried to avoid the man in front of him. The officer testified at trial that that's what the defendant told him. The defendant at trial and later before that in his deposition said, well, I don't remember. He tried to disavow it. But the fact is the evidence was put forth in court that the defendant himself said, I tried to avoid hitting the van in front of me. That is nothing but a voluntary action. And second, I would talk about the difference between, the definition of voluntary, I guess. If you make a conscious choice to do something, you're making a voluntary action. And I believe that is the proper legal standard.
I guess the difficulty I have is exactly with the point you've just made, is how you can have a voluntary action when you're being pushed through space.
Yes, sir.
If you can control the car,
mm-hmm.
It seems to me that can be voluntary. But trying to avoid and having steering input and hitting the gas when you've been propelled into the position you're in, I just can't see how, as a matter of law, that's a voluntary choice.
Okay. And I would say I believe that's a question of fact for the jury to determine, and they never were given that opportunity.
Yeah, that's why I phrased it as a matter of law.
I know you did, Your Honor, and I just wanted to say, first, I believe it's a question of fact, but secondly, the expert testified that what happened as a natural result of the first accident, where the defendant was hit from behind, is that he was pushed forward towards the van in front of him and basically clipped him. Had he done nothing, which was a choice, he could have done nothing, he would have hit the van in front of him and stopped. And relatively little damage would have been done because he was not going very fast. He chose to turn the wheel. Now, the question of voluntary is not whether he voluntarily wanted to hit the person on the sidewalk. Did he make a voluntary action to change the direction of his vehicle? And in fact, he did. And there was evidence. He said he tried to avoid hitting the car. That's voluntary.
Okay. Changing the direction of your vehicle, though, doesn't necessarily violate the ordinance. You have to drive up on the sidewalk. And so just because he consciously or voluntarily turned the wheel, does it follow that he made a conscious or voluntary choice to drive up on the sidewalk?
It may or may not, but that's not the standard. You don't have to voluntarily drive on the sidewalk. You're not allowed to drive on the sidewalk. And that's the strict liability nature of the statute. You're just not allowed to do it. Unless, if he's pushed, well, right, but that's the question of fact. Is he pushed, or did he take an action that caused him to do it? Now, if I'm just driving along the road, and I just turned my wheel because somebody dropped something in my lap, I've driven onto the sidewalk. Nobody else's fault. I moved the vehicle. I did a voluntary action that caused me to go on the sidewalk. If I hit somebody, it certainly isn't the person on the sidewalk's fault. And the expert testified that pushing him would not have put him up on the sidewalk. Pushing him would have propelled him straight forward into the van. And that's the question. The fact is, do you believe that, or do you believe the other science expert who said, no, pushing him would have pushed him over there? But the question on negligence per se is, did we present evidence that was something other than being pushed, and we did. The question is not how quickly he decided what to do. It's whether he chose to do something other than take the natural course of being hit from behind, which would have led him straight. So I believe the choice, although quickly, and maybe not reasoned, Maybe he didn't have time to evaluate, well, should I turn left, should I turn right, should I just go forward? And I think that gets to more of the question of the court, whether he had time to decide what the best choice was. He may not have had time to decide what the best choice was. I do believe that's still a question of fact, but as a matter of law, it's not what the statute requires. The statute requires you not to do it. It removes that choice from you. If you choose it, consciously or unconsciously, you violated the statute. If he fell asleep at the wheel and ran up on the sidewalk, it's still his fault. He didn't consciously go on the sidewalk, didn't decide to go on the sidewalk. He's just not allowed to do certain things.
And it, so any reflexive action is voluntary?
If it was reflexive, you could argue that it was because he was pushed, but our expert clearly said it was not reflexive. It was not caused by him being hit from behind.
I'm not sure. Is that what the expert said? The expert said, in his opinion, mm-hmm. Based upon the vector forces involved, it was. I don't know that he can get into the driver's head to see whether it's reflexive or not.
Well, the driver's own statement to the police officer then does. He said he tried to avoid hitting the van in front of him.
That could imply a reflexive action, though. If a car suddenly comes up, and you have a second, and you reflexively steer. In a layman's sort of explanation, it doesn't mean that I consciously thought about which way to go. It could just mean that I tried to avoid it by reflexively steering the wheel.
And respectfully, I disagree with the reflexive versus choosing. And the question about I'm trying to avoid the car in front of me is a conscious decision on my part. I take an action based on that conscious decision to turn the wheel one way or the other. The law took out the opportunity for him to choose to turn to the right because there was a person on the sidewalk there in a wheelchair that he needed to stop before he proceeded, because he wasn't looking before he turned, a whole number of reasons that as a driver you're not allowed to just put other people at risk in order to avoid the thing that you see. I mean, that's why those regulations are there. You just can't. It may be a great idea to plow down the 50 people on the sidewalk to avoid hitting the van in front of me for me. I don't get to hit those people to avoid injury to me. And that's what he chose to do. Now, I'm not saying he meant to, but that's the decision they made, and it was clearly a decision. And the question here is whether there was evidence of that presented from which a jury could find that. And the statement to the officer that he was trying to avoid hitting the van shows that there was at least some decision on his part, a choice of behavior. It wasn't just getting pushed in that direction. And that's where the strict liability comes in. There is no mens rea required. He didn't have to have any mens rea at all. He didn't have to be negligent. He didn't have to think about it. He just had to do it, and you're not allowed to do it, is the argument under the statute. And I can find no evidence in any case that says there's any way to avoid that lack of mens rea, that you have to make some kind of deliberate decision. You just simply can't do it, and he did it. And that's really what the negligence per se comes down to and why it's such an important issue. And it's because the difference between negligence and negligence per se. Any other questions about that or anything else? I'll reserve the remaining 2.5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Murphy. Mr. Burroughs.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Let me ask you.
Yes, sir.
If there's a scintilla of evidence in the record.
It's Mr. Levy.
Excuse me. Are you Mr. Levy?
Yes, sir. I was going to.
I've got the wrong person underlined on my sheet.
I'm sorry.
My cheat sheet. I apologize. Mr. Levy, if there's a scintilla of evidence in the record, doesn't Mr. Murphy get an instruction?
Not if it's harmless error not to give the instruction. And not if the scintilla of evidence in the record was incompetent evidence. Those are my two answers to that one, Your Honor.
Explain a little bit why it's harmful. It would be harmless error.
Because if, for example, there is, if the sort of the way I sort of wanted to argue this, Your Honor, this afternoon, is it's a sort of the so what standard. And the case law is very clear. That's the Antolovich case. And First of all, I need to go back and start off with, we think that the appellant is mistaken with respect to the standard of review. We don't think it is a de novo standard of review, but an abuse of discretion standard of review. The de novo standard of review goes when there is a an acceptance. The allegation is that there is an instruction that was given that was improper. Then that's a de novo standard of review. But if it's the refusal of a tendered instruction, it's an abuse of discretion point of view. So then we go to the standard that if the duty on which a jury is instructed is just as stringent or more stringent than the duty in an applicable statute, the failure to instruct the jury is not prejudicial and is harmless error. And is sort of stated another way. I had written down here. If the record, the appellant must show that there's a reasonable likelihood the jury would have answered the question differently. Now here, the appellant, Mr. Schumach, was given every opportunity to argue every theory of his case within a general negligence standard of care instruction. And if you take any of Mr. Schumach's theories of the case, and there are sort of several here that he presented that are somewhat inconsistent, including that we intentionally ran him down. No jury could reasonably conclude anything that they are presenting as an offer of theory of the case and say that it did not violate a standard of care of exercising reasonable care.
Well, it is a lower threshold, isn't it, the negligence per se, if you could get a negligence per se instruction.
I don't think that's always true. And again, the other way,
under this particular ordinance, if you just had, if we were to go along with their argument and say that all he had to do was show that that he drove onto the sidewalk and did some steering to have done that, that doesn't sound like ordinary negligence, but the ordinance might change that standard, might it not?
And sir, with all due respect and at some risk here, I'm going to disagree with that analysis. All because right. I'm going to phrase it a little differently here. If the instructions were given, the standard that the appellant has to meet here is that these instructions were necessary for him to be able to argue his theory of the case, and that without these instructions, the jury would be confused and would not be able to find a breach of the standard of care otherwise. One thing that is undeniable in this case is that the appellant, Mr. Schumach, the plaintiff here, had every opportunity to present every element of his case. You'll notice one of the things we argued in the briefs is that their accident reconstructionist should never have been allowed to testify at all for various reasons. But he was, and he was allowed to go sort of through the whole full panoply. Negligence per se, I think, is designed, and negligence per se is not an automatic rule. It is a discretionary rule with the trial court that if there is sufficient competent evidence to support the giving of instruction, then the trial court should, but it's harmless error if otherwise the jury has been sort of properly instructed and would be able to reach the same conclusion otherwise.
Doesn't it just basically take the negligence out of the jury's analysis, though? The negligence per se, if he violated the ordinance, then basically they don't have to decide anymore if he violated a breached the standard of.
Well, actually, I believe the way the instruction reads is that you may find that a violation of the statute is negligent. I don't think they say you must find that a violation of the statute is negligent. I could be just a little incorrect on that particular point. But I think when you're looking at an analysis of was it necessary to give, and the necessary word is one that I'm going to harp on a lot today here in my few minutes, but if it was necessary to give the instruction, then it's necessary to show the jury that there is some higher standard of care that would not ordinarily be known or would not ordinarily be subsumed within the general negligence of duty to exercise reasonable care. It is silly, with all due respect, to argue that a jury could find that it was not negligent to intentionally drive up on a sidewalk and hit somebody in a wheelchair under a standard of care of negligence, and that the jury would need to be told that that is somehow otherwise illegal. But as the court also knows here from reading our briefs, our argument is that there was not even a scintilla of evidence that supports the giving of any of these instructions under the standard. I can use a couple of other examples. I had a case once where a guy on a job site made a job-made ladder made out of 2x4s. A jury's not going to necessarily know there's anything wrong with that or that there's anything illegal about that, but it happened to violate an OSHA standard. That's the kind of thing that the jury might not necessarily know is subsumed within the standard of care. But their theory, no matter which one you take, and again, they presented inconsistent theories. They presented evidence from Mr. Schumach that we stopped. We looked around. We looked him in the eye. And then we decided to intentionally jump up on the curb and run him down. Now, would a jury find that to be within the standard of care under the instructions that were given? The answer is yes. And so if it's not necessary to give these additional instructions, again, what did these additional instructions add that were necessary to show the jury that there's some sort of higher duty of care? Let's take one about somebody being disabled, being on the sidewalk. That did not apply here. There was no way that Mr. Schumach was approaching the James vehicle or that Mr. James was approaching Mr. Schumach. They were both going the same way. And again, my analogy would be, I walk out of this building today, I go over to Lincoln where I park my car. If I happen to see a disabled person coming out of the library, I don't have to stop there. If I happen to see a disabled person going southbound on Lincoln, as I'm going southbound on Lincoln, I don't have to stop there. Now, if I see that disabled person starting to come across in front of me, even against the light, that's when you would have the necessity of putting in that sort of statute or that sort of ordinance to show the jury. For example, another great example on this, is pedestrians have a right-of-way if they're in a crosswalk, even if they're crossing against a light. Now, again, that would not be something that would necessarily be known to the average juror. It would be necessary to give that additional instruction to tell the jury that a pedestrian has a right-of-way even if they're crossing against the light, and you have to exercise some additional due care. And then I'll come back to sort of the evidence in this particular case. Did we violate the statute? Did Mr. James violate the statute by rear-ending the car in front of him? You know, that's one thing here that we just haven't heard anything about. But he rear-ended the car in front of him. Why? Because he was pushed into the car in front of him. And again, nobody has seriously argued that he should have been given a ticket for hitting the car in front of him. And these are sort of concepts here that I'm going to call sort of the elephants in the room, that this entire case is based on this fiction. Mr. Smith, I don't believe, ever once testified there was a volitional act involved in any of this. The only evidence that we've had presented, the scintilla of evidence presented, is that there was steering input, and this is assuming Mr. Smith should have been allowed to testify to any of this at all, but that there was steering input and that there was acceleration input. And again, I want to go back to some of the points made earlier with respect to this. I know of nowhere where Mr. Smith said there was some volitional act. There has to be some volitional act.
Was there a statement that didn't the officer indicate that he was told that he tried to avoid the van in front of him?
Yes, after he was hit. Okay, and then we have the testimony, and I'm going to submit to you all that under the testimony given by Mr. Smith, physics disallows this entire argument. It is undisputed in this case. Mr. Smith testified himself that this entire matter occurred in 1.3 seconds. That was his testimony, and this is at the record, volume 4. It's a date of trial, 4/10/2007, and pages 51 and 52 of that particular record. And this is something that was sort of referenced. And then Mr. Smith also testified that it is, again, his opinion, industry standard, et cetera, that it takes 2.5 seconds to do some kind of perception and then reaction to have a volitional act. And he testified to that. That was undisputed, unrebutted testimony at page 51 and 52. And this is after Mr. James got hit at somewhere between 40 and 80 miles an hour. And again, if we're going to argue that he could have been, that he violated the statute or the statute was necessary to be given, but then again, then he's also guilty of rear-ending the car in front of him. It's against the law to jump off a bridge. Somebody pushes you off the bridge. You can't be held responsible. And again, I'm going to present to you all that there is not even a scintilla of evidence, and certainly not competent evidence, that there was any volitional act employed by Mr. James at all, even if he says to the police officer, yes, once I got hit, I tried to avoid the car in front of me in 1.3 seconds. The fact that there was steering input, even if you assume Mr. Smith, and we had a lot of problems with Mr. Smith, but you can see it from the briefs, he essentially cherry-picked. Mr. Smith should never have been allowed to testify for lots of reasons, and this is plain error. Now, I understand we did not cross appeal on this, but this is another factor under the evidentiary rules.
We can't really consider that without a cross appeal, can we?
I believe you can under the rule that it is that if the evidence is, and we cited this at the, I think this is our last argument in the brief, that if the scintilla of evidence is not competent, then it need not be considered. But I also believe you can under the plain error rule, Your Honor. And there's just three points I want to make about that with respect to Mr. Smith. And I understand that disclosure things, et cetera, are within the trial court's discretion. But number one, Mr. Smith cherry-picked evidence. He ignored lots of evidence. He ignored witness statements because they were done through an interpreter. Mr. Smith was also allowed to offer and proffer evidence about whether or not Mr. James was telling the truth, which, again, should not have been allowed. And I'm going to reference back to the Kumho Tire case, because this gets to, we were not given an opportunity to appropriately voir dire Mr. Smith at trial, because the trial court assumed that the only issue on voir dire was whether he was qualified by training and experience, not whether he had employed appropriate methodology.
So you're saying that these miscellaneous errors render his testimony incompetent?
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Smith's testimony is just as valid as the Kumho Tire expert, who was eminently qualified, who said that he went up and went to the tire and was able to rub his hands across the tire and able to determine if the tire was defective. We tried to ask Mr. Smith on voir dire, what methodology did you use? And the trial court would not allow us on voir dire, saying that the only relevant question was whether he was qualified to do this sort of thing. And then he was allowed to offer testimony on all this kinematic stuff that you heard had never been disclosed, based upon trial testimony that counsel had undisputedly received months earlier and waited until 4 days before trial to give it to us. And so Mr. Smith was allowed to offer that sort of testimony based upon that transcript that had never been provided before. So again, we think all that was plain error, but then you get down to what Mr. Smith said. And this is what Mr. Smith said, is in 1.3 seconds, believing the best he's got to say, in 1.3 seconds, there was steering input, there was acceleration input, which is even disputed by his own testimony, coincidentally, at about...
He says he can't avoid the Monroy vehicle.
I'm sorry?
The plaintiff's expert said, with everything else, he can't avoid the Monroy vehicle.
Yes, sir. That is correct. That was the vehicle in front of him.
Yes.
Yes.
So if he can't avoid it, I'm scratching my head trying to figure out how he voluntarily hit the victim here.
Well, he didn't say that he couldn't. He didn't say that he could have avoided the Schumach, Mr. Schumach. He didn't say that any of this was avoidable from Mr. James. What he said was there was driver input without any evidence that the driver input, again, no matter how you slice this, there has to be some volitional act. It can't be just somebody got pushed off the bridge or somebody got pushed into the intersection. And the evidence in this case, I would submit, is overwhelming that there was no such evidence of any kind. I'm also going to submit to the court that the trial judge abused his discretion when he said, I don't find that either Mr. James or Mr. Smith's testimony incredible as a matter of law. I think that was an abuse of discretion with respect, especially to Mr. Schumach. I mean, again, it's physically impossible for what he said to have occurred in 1.3 seconds. So if you strip it all away, however, the jury is left with a full set of instructions that allow the plaintiff to fully argue all of their theories of the case, to present to the jury any argument they wanted with respect to this, all of which a reasonable juror would find, if they believed it one bit, a scintilla, would be a violation of the general standard of due care. And we think it is important in this analysis and looking at this that the jury in this particular case found 0%, not even 1%. Based upon this testimony. So none of it was excluded. All of the arguments were allowed, and the jury had competent instructions from which they could find in favor of the plaintiff if they believed the plaintiff's theory. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. Mr. Murphy.
I think the evidence of plaintiff's expert that was just discussed shows the difference clearly between what could be avoided and what could not be avoided. He testified clearly that based on the speed, and it wasn't 80 miles an hour, it was more like 40 miles an hour, that, and it made him propelled to go 20 miles an hour. That's how fast a defendant's vehicle was pushed, 20 miles an hour, not a rocketing speed. The expert testified he had no way to avoid hitting that van in front of him, no matter what he did. Turn left, turn right, slam on the brakes, go straight. He was going to hit the van in front of him, and in fact, he did. He clipped the rear right passenger side of that van. But he could avoid hitting Mr. Schumacher on the sidewalk had he done nothing. He wasn't forced up onto the sidewalk. He wasn't at a stop with his wheel turned for some reason, and therefore getting hit pushed him over that way. That's just not what happened. He was pushed in front of, into the van in front of him. There's no dispute about that. He was not pushed onto the sidewalk to hit Mr. James because he couldn't have been. He had to steer and he had to hit the gas. He simply wasn't going fast enough to do what he did. And he wasn't in the right direction, which means he made a choice. He made it quickly. He made it ill-informed. But he did a volitional act, and that's what the negligence per se goes to. Now, the... Supreme Court has found that violation of the violation of a statute or ordinance regulating the use of a roadway is negligence as a matter of law. And this is Reed v. Barlow, Colorado Court of Appeals, Colorado Supreme Court, 1963. It's in the brief. It's a very straightforward standard. Did he violate the statute? Did he not? If there's a question of volitional action, it is a question of fact. Their expert testified he had no choice. He got pushed up on the sidewalk. Our expert said he did have a choice. He chose to turn the wheel and go up on the sidewalk. The police officer said he told me that he made a choice. He was trying to avoid the man in front of him. That's conflicting evidence. And the court in Russo v. Barron Court, a division of this court in 1988, found if there's evidence in dispute, you've got to give the instruction. And the instruction is not the same standard. I see I'm out of time. So.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Thank you, Mr. Levy. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. Thank you.